Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning. I mean, good afternoon.
Good almost. It's still morning.
Good day, Beth Ann.
And hello to you, too.
You know, I think that's probably the best way to go. We're still obviously adjusting to our time change, but we're also adjusting to something far more serious today, the announcement in the paper this morning.
Right. This morning, we woke to the news that the Department of Homeland Security had released deportation rules derived from President Trump's executive orders on immigration and border security. The change of whether they change the enforcement priorities, and they include the removal of undocumented people convicted of a crime, any crime, not just serious crime, as had been the policy in the Obama administration. Now, congregations around North America from many faiths are promoting a sanctuary movement in response. So what about Hawaii? While there's been talk, are Hawaii congregations taking any actions on behalf of illegals here? We called Reverend David Gerlach, no stranger to social justice issues, and he's in our studio now. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning to you. Thank you for having me.
As you understand the term sanctuary city, what does that mean, just for clarity's sake?
As I understand it, it means that cities aren't going to actively cooperate with the federal government in identifying undocumented persons in their city. So that unless somebody commits a serious crime, their status in this country is not something that the local police are going to concern themselves with.
That may be changing under these new rules, the whole issue of crime, as we just talked about in the opening. But we should also, for clarity's sake, say that Hawaii is not a sanctuary city.
No, although I think as a practical matter, I think our police department has adopted that kind of policy where they're not looking at someone's immigration status as part of traffic stops or other kind of incidental interactions with law enforcement.
If that changes, then we will have a whole other issue to be talking about. But as you have been talking to those in the faith community now and looking at all the other issues that have to do with not just turning someone in, but really protecting someone,
right,
the whole notion of sanctuary that was offered to those who would walk into churches, you know, for hundreds of years. Is that, in fact, what you and those in the faith community are talking about?
Yes, indeed. In fact, just last Friday, over 40 people from many different congregations gathered at the Quaker's house in Manoa to discuss exactly this issue. And there are a number of congregations across denominational lines that are actively discussing identifying themselves as sanctuary sites.
And whereas you don't want to necessarily identify them now until they're ready to identify themselves, what specifically are you talking about in saying, yes, we're a sanctuary site? What would you do for someone who might come knocking on your door?
Well, you know, the big issue here for me is what does it mean to be church? And for far too many years, what it's meant to be church is basically to practice a kind of American civil religion where we worship God and the bomb and apple pie all in the same breath. But I think what's happening, particularly in these stressful times, when for many of us it has eerie echoes of the 1930s with so much hatred and vitriol and people in positions of great power setting people against each other, is are we people who admire Jesus or are we people who follow him? And it was Pastor Bonhoeffer, the famous Lutheran pastor who was arrested and killed by the Hitler regime, who said that as Christians, we don't have a choice in these matters. The choice has been made for us already. The question is whether we will do what we are required to do. And we are required as Christians to welcome the stranger, to protect the alien, and to care for the vulnerable in our midst. To not do those things or to support legislation and laws that are opposed to those is not to be Christian.
We may think of ourselves in the United States as being those who follow Judeo-Christian background of various different types. But in practical terms, we have lots of people here from many different traditions. We have many Muslims in the United States. We have others who have come who are Baha'i, who are Buddhist, who are Hindu, And we tend to focus on this idea of sort of the Judeo-Christian way of looking at things, not necessarily that tradition as being the one and only. How broad-based is this idea of becoming sanctuary and networking those communities together nationally and perhaps here in Hawaii too already?
I think all of the great faith traditions all share that common belief that we need to look out for the most vulnerable. It cuts across interreligious lines. And our Muslim brothers and sisters here have been quite active, and we have worked closely with them in opposing, for example, the recent ban on folks coming from different countries in the Middle East and Africa. Our Buddhist brothers and sisters have been extremely involved for many, many years in these very kinds of issues. So yeah, I expect this to be very broad-based. And the closer it gets to home, I think the more activity we'll see.
Is this setting up church against state?
It may, and that's an appropriate place for the church to be. We are called, I can only speak from my Christian tradition, but we are called to be witnesses to the kingdom of God. Well, if God's got a kingdom, it's naturally going to bump up against the kingdom that we, in our best thinking, come up with. Because with us, we somehow manage to have fantastic income inequality. We manage to have never-ending wars. And we somehow manage to find ways to be antagonistic with each other. And all of that is completely anathema to the kingdom of God.
In Hawaii, we tend to think that we are different from folks on the mainland. We have a different population, certainly. We are geographically the most remote place from any place else. As we talk to ourselves in this conversation and then also speak to those who are throughout North America, even today with Montreal saying that it's also a sanctuary city, although there have been really no benefits appropriated to be able to help in that regard. But as we have these conversations in the micro and the macro sense, what is it that you think that we really need to focus on in making those actions self-evident and not just conversation?
Well, I think in Hawaii, we can be and are a real role model for much of the rest of the United States. It seems that so much of what's being driven right now is based on fear from my age group and my ethnicity. You know, older white men are scared, it seems. And yet here in Hawaii, we've shown that we can live with majority-minority populations very well with each other and get along and learn with from each other and grow with each other. I think that is a witness to the mainland. And for the rest of it, we'll just have to see. It seems that these immigration efforts are being targeted primarily at folks from Mexico and Central America. Our largest group of undocumented people are from the Philippines and Japan. One wonders how much of this is just racist and race-directed, and we'll have to see how difficult ICE gets with the undocumented here in Hawaii.
Because our populations are so different, as you just said, that efforts on the mainland looking more to those who are Hispanic, Mexican, Central American, and we here have such a different population, do you think that brings us closer or causes more reason to feel more removed from what's happening on the mainland?
I think it's probably some of both, quite frankly. We are far away, and in some ways that can be a real, it can be distressing. That we don't have the impact maybe that our actions over here would have if we were all in Indiana or something like that. But we are where we are, and we need to do what we need to do here in our own place.
Do you have an estimate that you consider to be a very good estimate of how many undocumented folks there are in Hawaii?
My understanding is there's somewhere around 20,000.
Not exactly a drop in the bucket.
It's not. It accounts for, I believe, about 1.4% of our total population, which is still a significant number of human beings.
So when you're talking about what would you do for those people, what are you prepared to do for them should the need arise? And should these rules, in fact, mean that someone who might have shoplifted or, you know, committed fraud on some paperwork and suddenly is now in the crosshairs of immigration officials?
Yeah, my own sense is that within the next several months, there's going to be at least a dozen dozen churches in our state who identify themselves as sanctuaries, which would be different than how a city is a sanctuary. If a church serves as a sanctuary, that means somebody who is at risk of being deported would come and live at the church and remain at the church. And we would challenge the federal officials whether they really want to come on holy ground and take away a family member for something that is along the lines that you've just described.
What you've just said is that, you know, holy ground could become a battleground.
But the battle will be fought with non-resistance, non-violence, and with love and compassion, not only for those who are being housed, but for those who are attempting to take them.
We talked a little earlier about the meeting that you had on Friday among several denominations. Have you also reached out to, you know, police officials and others who might be instrumental in aiding the cause?
That hasn't happened yet. I'm sure that is something that will occur.
What would you ask them to do?
Primarily to continue what they are doing. I don't think anybody objects that if an individual is undocumented and has committed a violent crime or a very serious crime that causes serious injury, that that person probably shouldn't be here. But that's not the vast majority. And the vast majority simply contribute to our society, pay taxes for benefits they often don't receive because they're not eligible, and are contributing members of our community. We are, after all, a society based and built on immigration.
Are you at all concerned that some who might come through might cause disruption here in a way that we haven't seen? Immigrants, you know, because we mostly when we talk to officials who say, look, you know, we don't have any real documented cases of in Hawaii and just in general of having those who come through the immigration channels causing disruption, that in fact they come and they do quite the opposite, that they are trying to fit in, they're trying to repay a country that's given them an opportunity.
Absolutely.
But in this case where there is so much fear, you know, that whole miasma of fear and anger and angst that you talked about earlier, are you at all concerned that the scopes on all of those things will cause more of it, or that might, you know, breed some of it in a way that we haven't seen?
I don't know that people are going to react in that kind of way to the scrutiny. I worry that people are going to be driven underground. So I worry when I hear reports of a woman, for example, who is a victim of domestic abuse and doesn't report it to the police because she's undocumented. And then we find out that the perpetrator actually reported her as undocumented. So that is what's frightening. And I think that's what concerns, frankly, our local law enforcement, that they want the cooperation of our undocumented community so that crimes like that that occur don't go into the deep background.
With the fear that is taking many different shapes, I mean, certainly there were so many people who never even believed that Donald Trump could get elected president and spoke as if, you know, not at first dismissively, and then, you know, we all know what we saw last year. But it certainly made a group of people surface that we all now look at, and although you probably wouldn't put yourself in that position, although you might call yourself an older white male, why do you think this group of people has been so nasty, and how much vitriol, you know, we've seen from them in ways that we hadn't seen in past because they perhaps were so deeply underground, and now that they are above ground, are you concerned for what other damage they might be able to do?
I think that there's a percentage of folks who supported Mr. Trump who are from that category that you've described, the KKK folks and the David Dukes. But I think there's far more who are afraid, who have themselves felt that they've been left behind. As income inequality has gotten completely out of control, where 75 human beings have as much wealth as 3.5 billion other people on this planet, I think that fear generated a lot of his support. And that's always a regrettable thing because fear leads to opposing people against people. And it doesn't really attack the primary issue, which is, where's all the money going? Well, it's going to people like Mr. Trump and his pals and the folks that he's appointed to his cabinet, which is made up of a majority of billionaires. I think that's where the real problem is. And maybe we need to step back and take a look at that, that the problem isn't my African American neighbor or my undocumented Mexican neighbor who's just working to feed a family. It's people like Bill Gates, who, God bless him, does a lot with his money. But why does any human being need $62 billion? I think those are the questions we need to be asking.
The income inequality issue is a big one for you, and I understand that. But the idea of fear that has to be perpetuated needs fuel.
Yes, it does.
And so what do you see as being the fuel for that fear in a way that perhaps we haven't seen it?
I think it's an old story. It's by falsely setting up scapegoats in the community so that you can blame somebody who, in fact, is not blameworthy, while the people who are whistle past the graveyard. And I think that's what's happening today. We're looking at illegal immigrants as a cause of our problems, when in fact the real problems is we have too many billionaires and not enough equitable sharing of the wealth that everybody contributes to and everybody helps generate.
There would be some who would say, well, if this is a meritocracy and people who have earned on their own or through their own intellectual capabilities what they have, how do you put that into the context of, you know, sort of the American dream if you say that there are some who have far too much? Who's to say who has too much?
I think that's the big lie, because what has happened over the last 30 years is that we've got a group at the very top who only deal with each other. And so they sit on each other's boards of directors and they approve each other's executive compensation at rates 300 times the average worker's pay, and they serve each other. That is something that is relatively new in this country. From World War II until the late 70s, we had an expanding middle class. Since the 70s, the 80s, the so-called Reagan Revolution that even the Democratic Party bought into in many ways, we've had this confiscation of wealth by the wealthy, and that can be changed.
That sort of confiscatory way of being and the disconnect that it represents, how do you see that happening in Hawaii if you do?
Well, part of it is a lot of the work that we're doing to get affordable housing built, for example, and to have developers be required to have to build 20% of their units as affordable. These are things that help people move, you know, improve the benefit of their life and the quality of their life.
So just to short circuit this a little bit in the interest of time, because we're going to have to say goodbye in a moment, although we may not be a sanctuary city or a sanctuary state, from what I hear you say, that idea of sanctuary has to be brought into the fabric of daily living. And if there are challenges to those who are here and living as illegal immigrants, that the faith community will be willing to stand up and, in, if it has to, go against government.
Yes, indeed. That is what we are commanded to do by the one that we claim to follow. So, yes, we will do so.
Reverend David Gerlach, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Reverend David Gerlach is an Episcopal priest, a retired trial lawyer of 20-some-odd years' experience, and he's currently the sitting per diem family court judge. He is the rector of St. Elizabeth's Episcopal Church in Paloma.